Well, good morning. I have another bite-sized episode of the Public Relations Podcast for you, where I'm watching LinkedIn for interesting people saying interesting things and then making contact with them. Many of them are already my contacts, but there are a few people who've really got me thinking. And one of those people is Jaideep Shergill, who is the founding partner of Pitchfork Partners Consulting Group in Mumbai, in India. And I'm absolutely delighted that I managed to grab a few minutes with him today to catch up and find out a bit more about some of the comments that he was making. One was on sustainability in the music business. Another was on the current state of the Indian PR market and the impact of influencers. But it was quite an interesting story he raised, which was about an actor who had done a sort of PR stunt, which had rather backfired. So I'm really interested in his thoughts on that. And also just the nature of how PR now is global by its very nature. Even if you're a small organization, it is global from the start now. So first of all, JD, thank you so much for joining me. Well, I'll ask you a little bit about your work in a second, but I just wanted to start off first of all with this one about the bands. And it was an article that you mentioned on LinkedIn, or you said we should all read it, from Quilt AI. Because this looks at kind of attitudes on the internet towards things. And it was basically saying that bands now have to think about their environmental impact of transporting or their crew or their equipment and stuff like that around the world on a global tour. And that particularly pointed to Coldplay. It's really interesting, but can you tell us a little bit about why that struck you, first of all?
Well, firstly, you know, Quilt AI is a company based out of Singapore, and they are into inciting, as they call it. Mm. They essentially publish some very, you know, sort of, they publish very fascinating content, which I love. This particular piece stood out because I'm a big music fan myself. And I still remember back in the day when, you know, Bruce Dickinson of Iron Maiden would jump on a Boeing 737 and pilot it around the world.
Flight himself.
Flight himself. And then they would have like 300 people traveling around the world. And then, you know, that kind of carbon footprint that bands would be leaving year after year after year. Mm. And back in the day, it really, you know, I'm in my 50s now, so we didn't really care as much when we were young. But now I think the younger audiences, the Gen Zs and, the, you know, even Gen Y audiences, they're all activists now. I mean, young people are activists. They ask questions. They expect a certain behavior. All of them want their favorite bands to, you know, play a role with the
environment. Yeah, and you could see it in the data as well, couldn't you? That when they were asking people whether they were concerned about this, it was, I think it was like 75% or something like that, was saying that they were delighted when bands were doing things, wasn't it? It's not really a surprise.
And, you know, I've been seeing adverts that DHL as a brand has been putting out now for at least a couple of years, if I remember my dates. And these adverts are basically in partnership with Coldplay, which that piece talks about as well. And essentially what they're saying is that, you know, we'll manage the end-to-end logistics without, you know, creating the same kind of damage to the environment that bands did back in the day. And I think that's really a very, very big deal in my view. I mean, for a band to embrace that and for the audiences to expect that, both is a big deal.
There was one thing that struck me actually when I was reading that, and it was saying that some bands had, or the impression it gave me was that some bands had kind of just said, look, DHL are doing this for us, we don't need to worry about it. Whereas Coldplay had kind of come out and almost done this environmental audit where they were saying to fans, look, we have done this and this and this. And I quite like the way that they really embraced it. They almost, you know, they didn't just say, like, we're fobbing it off to DHL. They almost, like, said, we're taking personal responsibility.
And actually, Coldplay is one of the bands that does it, but there's a whole lot of other bands as well now who are very conscious about, you know, leaving the carbon footprint, about how they travel, about the number of crew they take on tours, you know, just the mode of transport, everything. I mean, they're just far more responsible now. And I think it's just coming from the, you know, the fans. The fans are activists. They're asking difficult questions. I mean, we've had situations where a big band like Metallica, for example, was doing a tour in the US, and they came up with this great idea. And that's not in this article, but I'll talk about it briefly. They came up with this great idea where they wanted their fans from all over the world to participate, but they didn't want to travel to like 30 countries because it was just too much of you know, time and effort and environmental damage and all of those things. So they actually beamed their shows live into auditoriums in Mumbai and Delhi and Bangalore and all over the world. So audiences here could like sit in an auditorium and watch them play live on a big screen.
Do you think that's a little bit of a difficult thing? Because I wonder sometimes, well, there is, I mean, we know in amongst the public, amongst ourselves, there is always a hypocrisy. It's a bit like fast fashion. You know, we all go, oh, fast fashion, it's bad. And yet we go out and buy it. And we've got this situation with bands whereby we're saying, look, actually, we want them to come and perform live. We want to see them live, and yet we don't want them to travel. And that puts those bands in quite a difficult PR situation because they've got to be environmental. And yet, somehow you've got to transport that kid around the world, haven't you? So it's like, how would you kind of view that? What do you think is the key thing they need to think about from a PR perspective on that?
I mean, you know, I just think they need to innovate. I mean, the example that I gave of the Metallica situation, I mean, that was an amazing innovation, right? Because what you're doing is you're probably playing in four or five cities, but you're getting people from like 100 cities to come and watch you. Now, of course, for the band, it's probably really not that sort of lucrative, let's put it that way. But for whatever it's worth, they make more fans. They get more fans. I mean, they get younger fans, more importantly, because, you know, you're talking about a lot of these people who are not necessarily getting 18-year-olds now to watch their concerts because 18-year-olds may not have grown up on that music. And if I want to convert these Gen Z people, and if I'm Metallica or I'm Coldplay or I'm whoever, I've got to find, you know, more innovative ways of communicating and doing my PR. And this is some of these things that we're talking about are really smart ways in my view.
I love that. It's actually taking advantage of the situation. It's not only being environmental, but it's looking for new opportunities that are being presented within it by listening to your fans, isn't it? Or potential fans.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think technology has helped immensely. I mean, you know, in the pre-COVID world, it was a different world. I think everyone's figured out that there's a way to do things using technology and virtual experiences and, you know, all of those things that have come into entertainment now, which are definitely going to help the carbon footprint.
Yeah. It's really interesting. JD, tell us a little bit about Pitchfork, just before we talk about the Indian market, because you've got a really interesting one that you were talking about there.
Yeah, so Pitchfork is a company that I co-founded a little over 9 years ago, and I've been in this business for nearly 30 years overall. I co-founded another company in the late 90s, early 2000s. That company was acquired by Publicis Group, the big holding company. I was part of that. Then I was playing some sort of role abroad and different markets. I was in Singapore. I came back and then I decided, you know, I wanted to go back to doing something that I enjoyed. And this firm was essentially set up as a boutique. It still is. I mean, we're very clear that, you know, we don't want to go back to being big again because that's like kind of the easy thing to do, right? You just keep adding people and clients and, you know, just keep growing and all of that. But having done that before, I think the sort of goalpost in some ways has shifted. And then the communication world has shifted too, because it's no longer about, you know, traditional media and, you know, articles in the press and all of that. I mean, one's got to be able to do better content. One's got to be able to work across formats, across markets, all of that. And that was what led to this company being what it is now. So we call ourselves a strategic communications firm. Essentially, because a lot of what we do is sort of more strategic, not only execution. I mean, we do execution, of course, but we add a level of sort of strategy on top of everything. And that's largely to do with the fact that we employ a lot of senior folks. Mm-hmm. That in itself is a unique model in India, because not in the UK and not in America, where, you know, there have been firms like this for many, many years. But in India, it's kind of only full service firms, really, before this company was set up.
I'm really interested, though, in what you were saying about staying small, because I've heard this debate before about some people that are just going, you know, big or small, because if they're smaller, they can focus a bit more and they can be more creative rather than just, you know, doing the standard, just pumping out press releases or whatever, isn't it? I mean, what was it for you? Why did you prefer to keep it tighter?
Well, firstly, just going from my past experience, right? Because we did start small a couple of times before, but then the previous sort of companies went on to become these really large companies.
Yeah.
And the last company that I set up went on to become like a 500-person business. And then when this one was being set up, we were like, you know, we don't want to do that again. Like, if we don't want to do the rat race thing all over again. But then we also want to make a difference to clients, right? Because one of the complaints one always gets from clients is, you know, that we don't get senior counsel. Everyone's running around.
It's less personal. It's all about management and all about HR and stuff like that, rather than actually doing the stuff.
I had, at some point in my career, I'd become an administrator, as I like to call myself, in those days.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be an administrator. I wanted to work with clients and I wanted to work with teams and I wanted to be in the middle of the action. And that can only happen when you're small, because you can only work on a handful of companies or brands or causes that really matter. And you can still be profitable. It's just that you've got to find a balance and you've got to at some point slow down and say, you know, at this point, we don't take on more work, or we don't hire more people, or whatever that limit is. And then you just do better work and, you know, you just try and work with clients longer, increase the longevity of your relationships, hopefully get better budgets for the work that you do.
Keep it tighter, but more powerful.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let me ask you about this influencer story that you were commenting about, because this really struck me. This is about an actor that was doing some work or may have been doing some work for cervical cancer, wasn't it? Just tell people what actually happened.
So, you know, in countries like India and all over the world, cervical cancer is one of the bigger causes for women especially dying. And unlike many other types of cancer, which don't have sort of preventive medicine, cervical cancer actually does. So there are a couple of companies in the world who have vaccines. And if one takes those vaccines, you know, you can actually avoid cervical cancer. Now, that's actually a big deal, because it's a massive innovation in an area like cancer. You know, they've been trying to communicate that in the Indian market, because India is a big market, actually. And they've been trying to tell, you know, young girls and women, you know, go out and get the vaccine and all of that. And at some point, and no one is entirely sure, because now everyone's sort of running away from it. But at some point, somebody decided that they wanted to build awareness for cervical cancer. And so essentially, they brought in this model. She's very famous. And in India, as I was saying, you know, there's religion, Bollywood and cricket. Three things that we live for and we die for, as they say. So because any celebrity or any influencer that comes from cricket or from Bollywood is naturally going to get a lot of traction. So they brought in this model slash actor, and, you know, she put out a post on her Instagram account. This was just like 4 or 5 days ago, actually. And she said, I mean, her post essentially read that, you know, she passed away because of cervical cancer. And the whole country was...
I've died.
No, well, she didn't say...
Not I've died, but it said something along the lines of that she had passed away, yeah?
Yeah. Her post said that we lost her to cervical cancer. And everyone said, oh, this is terrible. I mean, she was only in her 30s, mid-30s or something, And the whole country, because she's sort of a Bollywood actor and model, everyone was, you know, seriously concerned. And there were articles coming in the media. Some of the top media outlets in India, the A-list media outlets, picked up that Instagram post, started writing articles. People tried contacting her family. They weren't reachable, but everyone thought, you know, she must have died. So they're obviously busy with, you know, with whatever was happening with her funeral and all of that. So no one really wanted to go too deep. They just picked up what they saw on social media and published it and republished it. And other actors in Bollywood started coming out and paying tributes, and, you know, all of that happened. I guess everyone just believed that she had actually died of cervical cancer, and it was pretty sad. Exactly 24 hours later, it turns out to be a stunt. And she comes out and says, you know, I didn't die. I was just trying to do this to build awareness for cervical cancer, because it's very serious and we want people to come and, you know, understand the seriousness and get vaccinated. And that created a sort of storm in a well, not in a teacup, but real form. And that's when everyone started questioning the legitimacy of fact-checking. If the biggest media outlets can just take a post on Instagram and publish that, and without doing fact checks, without checking on the story, that just tells us how crazy this whole thing is. I mean, the world of PR is a scary place now, because one has to look at this situation very seriously and figure out what one can do to solve for it.
Yeah, I mean, there were two things that struck me the moment I saw you talking about this. And the first one was that you should never embarrass the press if you ever want to get their coverage again. And what she's done here is she's embarrassed them. She's humiliated them. The other side is you could probably argue that she has raised awareness of cervical cancer, but only by a little bit, because the story has changed from that very quickly into this was a terrible PR stunt.
Absolutely.
So, yes, she's probably got a few people saying, well, it was about cervical cancer. But the actual knock-on result, nah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's created more enemies than friends.
Yeah.
The media is upset. The Bollywood fraternity is upset. The public at large is upset. And, you know, everyone's like, you know, you can't play with people's emotions and mess around with people, because there are actually people who got cervical cancer and they're dying of it. And if you want to build awareness, do it in a smarter way. Rather than pulling off a dumb stunt like this. So it's actually backfired very badly, in my view.
How are they handling this now? Because this is put their own career in a lot of jeopardy. Huge amount of jeopardy, actually.
I mean, she after the first couple of days, she's clearly disappeared, because she's probably got advice from people to not show up and try to respond, and because then it gets into that, you know, cycle, and you can't undo it once it's sort of out, once the genie's out of the bottle, as they say. Mm-hmm. So she's clearly out of the picture. I mean, she's just in hiding or wherever. Mm-hmm. But the classical sort of paradox always is, who do you blame? So the first thing they did is they got rid of the agency, and the agency had to come out and apologize and put out a video and create a microsite and put out a press release saying, you know, we screwed up and, you know, this wasn't intended to be the way it turned out. We're sorry. We didn't want to hurt anyone's sentiments, et cetera, et cetera. So the agency was like thrown under the bus. Everybody else seems to have put their hands up, because nobody seems to be owning up to who actually put that campaign out, because it wasn't branded by a company or a NGO or whatever. And somewhere the agencies kind of had to take the fall, and they've had to. And actually, I heard the agency even had to put out a note saying that they didn't actually do this for any brand or an NGO, which I kind of find hard to believe.
Yes, it's a little bit suspicious, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, basically everyone's covering up now, right? And the only people who had to take the fall is the agency that ran the campaign and that did this whole thing. So it's kind of sad, but that's what's happening now.
What would you say are the key learnings for PR operatives from this particular thing?
Well, I think the learnings in some ways go back to the philosophy of what you were asking me earlier about why Pitchfork is as small as it is. Because I think mistakes happen when you go after business blindly. You don't have focus. You don't really know what you're doing. And more importantly, you know, you're just trying to come up with campaigns which are funny or over the top, or you think they're going to solve some problems, which they're actually not going to. And because you don't have the maturity in the communications team of the brand or the agency or whoever came up with this, I guess there'll always be slips like this, because as long as you don't do quality control, as long as you don't think and come up with you know, better insights, as long as you don't have a stronger approach to communication, I think PR agencies should really be worried now. Because, and it's not just this one example, because India is a country which, you know, sort of picks up on a trend and then gets bigger. So, you know, social media came to India many years after the rest of the world. But today, Instagram has more followers than the US in India, and Facebook has more followers in India than in the US. So India is one of those markets that starts slow but then picks up. And using influencers in PR is a more recent phenomenon in this country. unlike in the West or unlike in developed markets. But we are going through our own learning curve, as I like to put it, because we've seen a number of slip-ups like this. This isn't the first. This is the most recent, but it isn't the first. And we are seeing a whole lot of these slip-ups. And hopefully, the fraternity will learn and do better.
You make a really good point, though, about the fact that these kinds of things, you know, can happen. Because by the nature of PR, you've got to grab attention. So you've got to push the limit. But this is always a struggle, isn't it? Is how far can you go? And it's very hard, beyond having serious discussions within the organization that's deciding on the campaign and looking at the data that's out there about how people view things. You know, it's quite hard to know what is the absolute limit, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, in I've seen some campaigns backfire in the US and in Europe as well, where they've
tried to them. Yeah.
Loads of them. But I think there the difference was, it was more about two audiences. Half of them like something and half of them don't.
Sure.
And, you know, in countries like America right now, because they're so polarized anyway, only 50% of your... Yeah. Anything you do will only be appreciated by half of America and not the other half, depending on which half you're talking to. But this one, on the other hand, this is a complete disaster, because this is not a problem of... somebody not liking something, or half of India not liking it and the other half liking it. This is not one of those things. This is just a complete muddle, a complete mess. And I think it's just naive in my view.
What do you think went wrong, though? I mean, do you think this was a lack of proper discussion? I mean, what I'm trying to pull out of here is how other people can avoid it. So we obviously don't know exactly what happened inside there. We don't know.
Yeah.
But it's like, what could be the things that people should be watching out for is what I'm wondering.
Yeah. So I have two views on it, and I'm not sure which is the right one, because like I said, we don't even know who was behind this campaign.
No.
Because it's only been like 4 or 5 days. So the whole story isn't out yet. But I have two views. I mean, firstly, if the agency was doing this to prop up themselves, and doing this as a stunt to win awards or something, which a lot of agencies go down that rabbit hole, as you know, then that was just a complete mess on their end. And if they, you know, now they're claiming that it was just them who came up with the idea. It wasn't a brand or anything else that, you know, was supporting it. In which case, they were clearly doing it to just prop themselves up. Or probably doing this like, you know, wanting to do some award submission or something where it's like, you know, I came up with this amazing idea and now I can submit. I can go to the Cannes Lions and submit this.
Yes, the campaign for the submission. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So if that's the case, then clearly there's a problem with that agency then. If, on the other hand, if there are brands involved or NGOs or other organizations behind this, including the actor and model in question, then clearly it's a problem of them being either too naive or just not, you know, doing enough research or just not thinking about the ramifications and sensibilities behind something like that. And in that case, then, of course, there's a very different problem one has to solve.
I just wanted to finally ask you about the global aspect of PR now. And you alluded to this already about influencers and the way that it's spreading out around the world now. And this is something you're obviously dealing with yourself at Pitchfork. Is that everything is global now, isn't it? And where have you seen that really manifesting itself? With influencers or in some other way?
Actually, everywhere. You know, I mean, firstly on social media, because as I mentioned to you separately, the platforms that we use in India, unlike China and other markets, are all international platforms. So... the largest platforms in India are Instagram and X and Facebook and YouTube and so on. So that itself means that any piece of content that happens goes out of India or vice versa, coming in from somewhere else, is naturally available to all of us. Mm-hmm. In China, on the other hand, because they just don't have any of these people or any of these platforms, then it's very hard for anything to go in or go out. But India, on the other hand, is as global as it gets. And the same applies to traditional media outlets, because all of them now have moved to digital first titles or digital newsrooms and all of that. So when
they publish from around the world, everywhere, yeah.
When they publish stories in India, you can read them in Sydney and vice versa. Stories coming out of Sydney here. So, you know, the back in the day, you know, we used to have, I mean, I still remember back in like 15 or 20 years ago, every time we needed to do a global campaign, we had to actually call up people in like 5 or 6 or 10 countries and say, you know, there's this brand, they want to do this campaign. They want to hire teams on the ground. But there's a lot less of that happening now because you can literally sit anywhere in Iceland or Finland or you know, wherever you are, wherever your brand is, and you can actually come up with a campaign targeted specifically to the Indian market or to the Australian market or to whichever market you want to. And you can use traditional media, you can use digital media, you can use a combination. And you don't even need to have people on the ground to execute. You can literally just sit somewhere else and do it. So I think in some ways, the all markets except the closed ones, in some ways are all part of this one seamless sort of global network in some ways.
I think it's really exciting, though, because I think the opportunity for different people and different cultures and different backgrounds to work together also has been enhanced by this, hasn't it? You know, it's not just a one small agency in one country anymore. There's the opportunity to tap into skills and talent from all over the world, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, and it's the same with media, right? I mean, you know, when the in the old days, the PR guy was very powerful, or the PR lady was very powerful, because she had a Rolodex of numbers. She had the editor of FT on that. She had the editor of Wall Street Journal on that, and she had like all the top media guys on that list, and she knew them one on one. And that's why she got a lot of work, or he got a lot of work.
Yeah.
That's how PR was, right? I had my own like little address book, which had all like the top media guys that I knew. And all my clients gave me money because I was the guy who knew all of them. And they did. And now you can write to a journalist in New York Times from here. I can write to FT from here, and I can pitch a story to them. And anyone can, not just the PR folks. Anyone can now. I mean,
I was talking to a friend at the BBC the other day, and I was saying to her, look, do you actually read press releases anymore? And she was saying, no. I actually find most stories on Twitter and on social media. And if they've got a lot of support and a lot of comments, then they're probably something people are talking about. And then I follow it up from there. So putting out a tweet, which has got lots of likes, can be actually a lot more powerful now than sending out a good press release.
Absolutely right. And the press releases, I think, are not important for anyone anymore. Not just where you are, but even over here. I think it's more about pitching directly. And the insight that you just gave is absolutely right. We are seeing that happen here as well. We're seeing a lot of folks who pick up stories from social media and then run, evaluate them and look at them and then run those stories. Except when a stunt like this goes wrong, but other than that, yes.
that's an interesting one.
By and large, it's the other thing, of course, is the sort of flip side of the global point I was making is also the fact that there's a lot of fake news. There's a lot of news that isn't certified. There's a lot of news that's floating around about all kinds of stuff. And that's the scary part of this whole globalization situation that we were talking about. And that really needs to be reined in. I mean, everyone's got to play a role. I mean, it's going back to that Coldplay, situation about how fans are activists and consumers are activists. I think somewhere we all in our fraternity, in our community and everywhere else need to become very mindful of this.
I got to ask you about that. This is something I've spoken to other people about before as well, is the whole fake news challenge now. Because one of the problems that I think we're going to get in PR now is that you'll be able to put out a story and people will just dismiss it before they've even read it. So even trying to clarify a mistake that was made wrong or put out any new campaign, if people get to the point where they just don't trust anything, how do you build that trust? I don't know what the answer is on this one, but I can see this being a big challenge in the next few years.
Richard, actually, it's even more complicated than that. It's actually half and half. So every time you do something, or every time you put out a piece of content or news or whatever, there's literally like 50% of the people who'll believe that, and 50% of the people who won't believe that. And yes. And that in that 50% changes depending on what that news item is.
Yes.
And that is even more baffling, because it's not even like you can say everyone liked it or everyone didn't like it. We don't even live in those days anymore.
It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It's whether you want to believe it to be true, isn't it?
Absolutely. And if you happen to be the kind of person that embraces a particular philosophy or a viewpoint or a company or whatever it is, or a political party or whatever, then it doesn't matter whether it's fake or not, because you're converted. You're so converted that you'll believe anything. And that group will always be there. It's unfortunately, the trick is to find out which side they're on, and then work on that. And it's hard, like you said, it's incredibly hard.
JD, we have spoken massively longer than I intended to. I knew this was going to happen, because I knew you were going to be an interesting guy. You will come on again, won't you?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Yeah, because I feel there's so many more stories that we can cover and chat about here. So just tell people where they can find you if they want to reach out to you.
So I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. And my email ID is on our company website. On Twitter, it's at jdeep19 on Twitter.
Yep.
It's at jaidepep19 on Twitter. And an email
and the website for Pitchfork as well.
The website for Pitchfork is www.pitchforkpartners.com.
Wonderful. JD, it's been an absolute pleasure. I held you up, as I say, far longer than I intended to, but it was so interesting talking to you. I look forward to talking to you again. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you for having me, Richard. It was great fun. Thanks. Take care.